Board is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, Council. You ready to proceed?
We are.
Kevin Shannon on behalf of DuPont, I would like to introduce my co-counsel, David Patinsky of the Ballot Spar Firm, who will make the argument on behalf of DuPont.
Welcome, Counsel.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Lisa Schmidt. May I have Jim Fitzgerald from the firm of McGrath North? He has been admitted pro hoc and will make the argument on behalf of ConAgra.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court, my name is Stuart Shapiro, and I rise to argue on behalf of the appellant plaintiff below, DCV Holdings, Inc., the buyer in this situation. That's how I'll refer to it during the argument as a buyer. There are two different issues, in case one a fraud issue and one a contract issue. With the Court's permission, I'll address the fraud issue first. The Superior Court, as I'm sure this Court recalls, held on summary judgment that the sellers, DuPont ConAgra's written disclosures in connection with the sale, quote, had conveyed the material facts about the rebate, and that's the TMA rebate, and also reported the inconsistency with GAAP. That's in the summary judgment opinion at page 19. In April 2003, this Court reversed that holding and stated that there are material disputes of fact between the parties as to whether there was adequate disclosure of the, quote, bogus, close quote, nature of the TMA rebate, which was admittedly and properly obtained from DuPont by the management of DuCoA. DuCoA is the affiliate, the limited partnership, is essentially a subsidiary of DCV. If, as the sellers contended, their written disclosures made adequate disclosure of the bogus nature of the TMA rebate, this Court obviously would not have reversed or remanded for a trial. 1 year after trial, the Superior Court issued its opinion containing the same ruling as had been reversed on summary judgment, holding that the seller's written disclosures made adequate disclosure concerning the rebate. The Court stated the buyers knew that the booking of the unpaid rebate in 1996 constituted a GAAP violation. Both Halter's July 23 facts and the language of the disclosure statement clearly acknowledged that DuCoA used the rebate letter to obtain unearned executive bonuses and to inflate 1996 earnings. That appears on page 16 of the opinion. Now, the Superior Court's ruling last March is as wrong as it was in 2003.
Let me stop you there because I have a fundamental question about what the nature of your argument is. And there are three possibilities. One is that the Court applied the wrong rule of law. Are you contending that?
No, Your Honor, what I'm contending, I am with respect to
the second is that the Court applied the right rule of law but incorrectly to the facts. And the third possibility is that the Court found the facts wrong. Which of the three are you arguing?
It is really the third, Your Honor, and that is that the Court's opinion is not the product of a logical deductive process because there is overwhelming admission, there are overwhelming admissions by the defense witnesses that they knew, and it's a DuPont, there can be
If it's the third, yes. Tell us, in connection with the fraud claim, what facts were found wrong and why.
Sure. The facts that were found wrong were that the written disclosures disclosed that the TMA rebate was booked in violation of GAAP. The written disclosures, as this Court found in 2003, didn't make that disclosure. In addition, if one reads the written disclosures, they don't say anything about the TMA rebate being in violation of GAAP. In addition, Mr. Philip James, the senior ConAgra executive involved in the transaction, testified clearly that he read the disclosures and he did not learn from those disclosures that the rebate was booked in violation of GAAP. Floyd McInerney, the most senior ConAgra executive involved in this transaction, testified that he read the disclosures and they did not disclose that the TMA rebate was booked in violation of GAAP. Roger Wells, the lead lawyer for ConAgra and the lead legal negotiator in the matter, testified that he read the written disclosures and that he did not learn that the rebate was booked in violation of GAAP. Paul Halter, the senior DuPont executive, on the matter, testified in response to a question put to him by his own counsel, did you tell the buyer that there's anything bogus or illegitimate or wrong about this rebate? And his answer was absolutely not. So this is not a question of the plaintiff's witnesses saying we didn't learn it, although they all testified to that. This is the defendant's witnesses admitting that they did not tell the buyer that the rebate was booked in violation of GAAP or that it was bogus.
Are there other material facts that you contend were incorrectly decided?
Yes, Your Honor. There are a series of factual findings as to testimony by Mr. Sikorsky, the lead negotiator for the buyer, which...
Well, what I'd like you to do, just so we'll know where you're going, is tell us which material facts, that is, facts that are material to your position, were incorrectly decided.
Yeah. The Superior Court found that Mr. Sikorsky testified that he knew that the rebate was improper and that the executives who arranged for the rebate thereby obtained unearned incentive compensation by the inflation of revenues. And what Mr. Sikorsky, and there is no such testimony in the record. I've read every sentence that Mr. Sikorsky testified to. What he testifies to repeatedly is that he was told by Mr. Halter that the rebate was properly booked and was valid, and that's why DuPont was paying it. In fact, he testified to it so often that the trial judge at one point interrupted him and said, if you want to get out of here, you better stop repeating that. So that is a material fact that the court found without any record support whatsoever.
Anything else?
Your Honor.
Is it your contention that Halter knew it was not properly booked?
He testified to that, Your Honor. We quoted it in our brief, and if you give me a moment, I'll find it in my notes. Because I asked him on cross-examination,
Let's assume that one could read his answer as saying he knew it violated GAAP. Is there any indication in the record that Halter knew that it was really bogus?
Well, let me answer that, if I may, in two ways. First of all, the answer is yes. He got the Fisher memorandum that said, and he acknowledges this at page A567 of the record, appendix. He says that I knew there was no agreement for a rebate in 1996. That means booking it was bogus, because you can't, as a matter of accounting principles, book as revenue a contract that doesn't exist. And then I said, did you understand that booking revenue from a non-existent contract violates GAAP? And he said, yes. And then I said, so you knew on July 22nd that DECOA had booked a $506,198 rebate revenue that it had no right to book, correct? Answer, that's correct. That's page A567 at line 4, at 42. Philip Janes gave the same answer when I asked, when Mr. Margulies asked him that at trial. He said, so you had the Fisher memo that told you there was no agreement for a rebate, right? He says, right. And you knew that, but the buyer didn't know that, right? Right, that's correct. But there really is no issue here that they knew that. Now, Dr. Porta, who was the president of the company, testified that he was told by John Letty, the author of the fraudulent rebate letter, that there was no agreement for rebate, and that he told Halter. And Halter, and then Porter went on to testify that Halter said, you stay out of this. It's a DuPont matter. I'll deal with it. And that Halter thereafter testified, or said to him in a meeting, I've talked to the people who say there's a rebate, and I've talked to, and I know what Letty's position is, and I choose to believe the people who say there's a rebate. And, of course, then I asked him at trial, why didn't you call Letty? Find out he's your co-executive. He said, I was too busy. I said, well, you had 4 weeks until the closing. He said, well, I figured if I just paid the rebate, that would take care of it as a disclosure issue, and I didn't need to do anything further. So whether you find that he acknowledged that he knew, which I believe the record clearly shows, or you find that he was incredibly reckless because he knew there was an issue at the minimum and chose not to inquire, and thought that if he paid it, he could eliminate the problem. He's pinned. Now, the second part of my answer, Justice Holland, is I don't think it's relevant, because DuPont issued DuPont Company made the representation. DuPont Company knew that it had refused a rebate. DuPont Company knew that it issued a fraudulent rebate confirmation letter. And DuPont Company was told in July of 1997 by Pete Fisher, we booked that fraudulent rebate. The DuPont Company, which is responsible for the representation and warranty and is chargeable with the knowledge of its agent, made this representation and knew it was false at the time of payment.
But doesn't the agreement provide that we really have to focus on Halter?
I don't know. I don't see why, Your Honor. There's no definition in Section 3.8, which has to do with financial statements, that says it's limited to the knowledge of the sellers. That's not in 3.8. And indeed, our witnesses testified and their witnesses confirmed we would not have done the deal. We told them right from the beginning. They sent us a letter in January saying, we don't want to make any representations. And our negotiators from Skadden Arps said, then there's no deal. We can't finance an LBO without real core representations from the seller as to the financial condition of this company. So you either give us a representation unqualified that the financial statements are accurate, you give us an unqualified representation that there are no undisclosed liabilities, and you give us an unqualified representation that there are no material adverse changes, or that we won't negotiate with you further. And on May 20th, we sent them in April a draft agreement that had those unqualified representations in them. And after a lot of horsing around, on May 21st, they sent it back to us and agreed to those qualifications, or those unqualified representations. And thereafter, they never raised the subject again. So,
to what extent do you believe the record reflects or does not reflect support for the theory that the lower price that was later paid compensated for this rebate?
There is nothing in the record that suggests that, Your Honor. The letter that Mr. Sikorsky, which is at A114 of the record in the appendix, sent to the buyer or the seller asking for a reduction, said, thank you for your candor in disclosing the recent earnings shortfalls in 1997. You appreciate what position that puts us with our banks. That's why we're asking for a reduction.
So that's a third fact?
That's a third fact. The testimony of Paul Halter, the DuPont executive, and his notes, and his testimony is very interesting, and I commend it to the court, because he never says in that testimony in direct examination that the TMA rebate was the basis for the request for the price reduction. What he says is earnings were messed up by these accounting changes, these other ones. They caused some shortfalls, and that was the basis for the price reduction. What he said to the buyer, and what is reflected actually on his copy of the July 23 facts talking about these seven issues, is that the TMA rebate issue increased 1997 earnings by $90,000 because it resulted in a reversal of some write-offs that had occurred in 1997. And he then, at the end of his notes, calculates what the impact of these seven items are. And he shows $880,000 in shortfalls attributable to the other six items and $90,000 positive attributable to the TMA rebate.
As I understand the essence of your position, it isn't the magnitude of the change in the earnings. It's the fact that if you'd have known this, your client would have known you were dealing with scoundrels.
Yeah. When you do a leveraged buyout, you're not going to be the management. You're a financial institution. A Metropolitan Life Insurance Company puts money into something called Windward Capital Partners, which is an LBO outfit. They don't have managers. So they go look for a freestanding company that's generating historically nice cash flows and has some potential for the future. And they look to the historical cash flows, and Leith Mace, the MetLife fellows, testified to all this. They look for the historical cash flows to pay to service the debt and help retire, and they hope to make a real profit on new product development and the like. If you can't rely on the competence and integrity of the management, there's no way you can do the deal. If you can't rely on the integrity of the financial statements, your banks won't finance. That's the condition of the financing, is if you have valid, GAAP-compliant, approved, outside-audited financial statements. And Mr. Sikorsky testified to that without contradiction. Had they been told that this management intentionally created fraudulent, false financial statements steal $404,000 in bonuses. Nobody in his right mind would have gone near this company. And it's for two reasons. One, because you can't trust the people and you can't rely on the financial statements. But more importantly, if they're going to commit a crime here, what other crimes have they committed that I don't know about? You just can't do good business with bad people. And if you're going to be an investor in a leveraged situation where you're on the board, but you're not running it day-to-day or not bringing in new management, you can't possibly invest. And that's what Mr. Sikorsky and Mr. Mays testified to on. Without contradiction, there were no testimony from the other side. The materiality issue really is not one that should be in dispute at all in this kind of a transaction. And if I can shift to that to respond again to Justice Jacobs' questions about material fact issues, material fact mistakes, the entire materiality discussion in the opinion is based on non-existent, made-up testimony. And it's testimony that was taken, characterizations of testimony taken from the defendant's briefs. But when you go to the record, there is no such testimony. And that's what the Superior Court did. So the first thing that the Superior Court finds, which is on page 20 of the opinion, is that Mr. Sikorsky readily acknowledged at trial that he knew that Duke co-executives took unearned bonus money based on an unpaid rebate. And as I told you before, there's no such testimony in the record. He said, you know, when this issue came up, it raised the concern as to whether this rebate had something to do with getting incentive compensation, and I raised that. Mr. Holter flatly assured me that it was a valid rebate, it was viable, and as a result, there were no problem with management. And I took his word for it because it came from a company with integrity, had a long history of ethical dealing, and because he was in a position to know. He was on the board. So that fundamental finding simply doesn't exist. The second one we've been over, which is the TMA rebate, was the basis for a reduction. Does this mean I'm out of time? Let me, if I may, go on to the second, the contract issue, and try to deal with it. I guess I'll give up my rebuttal time. There are two fundamental errors, and they are matters of law in the respective contract issue. First, the Superior Court found that no liabilities existed at the time of the closing, and as a result, even if 3.9, the undisclosed liabilities provision applied, wouldn't matter. That's just wrong as a matter of law. The Zenith Radio Supreme Court of the United States held that when you violate the antitrust laws by selling a price-fixed good, a cause of action arises on behalf of the buyer. And obviously, a contingent liability arises on behalf of the seller. This court observed that in its order reversing summary judgment in 2003.
So your argument here is that the court applied the wrong rule of law?
The court didn't apply any rule of law. It cites to no authority whatsoever for its holding. Its holding is a simple sentence. It says there were no liabilities that existed without any support, either in the record or from case law. It's an error. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Fundamental to your argument regarding the antitrust indemnity is that Section 3.9 of the agreement governs.
Yes.
The court said that it didn't, or at least that it didn't supersede the provisions with the knowledge qualifiers.
Yes.
What's the nature of that contention?
Yeah,
wrong rule of law or right rule wrongly applied?
Wrong rule of law in both cases. First, the liabilities clearly existed under Supreme Court precedent. No question about it. Back, we got a $50 million treble damage judgment against us before this case was decided as a result of violations that occurred before the closing. Second, court said, I need to apply a construction principle that says the specific controls over the more general, and he cited the Cattell case, which is the then Vice Chancellor, the Chandler decision. That case doesn't hold that. That case holds that if the two provisions conflict, then you may look to the more specific to determine whether it controls the more general. There is no conflict between 3.9 and 3.13. As Jim Freund says in his Anatomy of Merger, which is the leading treatise on this issue, as Howard Ellen, the Skadden partner, testified, 3.13 is a pre-closing provision. It requires the management, for the seller to go talk to the management, find out if there are any violations of law, and if there are, report them so the buyer can decide whether he wants to close or not or walk away. So you violated pre-closing by either not making an inquiry or by not reporting what you find. 3.9, the undisclosed liabilities provision, is an indemnification provision. It allocates to the seller responsibility for any violations, any liabilities of any sort that occurred when he owned the company. And it says if post-closing one of those damages hits, the seller's liable for it, not the buyer. He has to indemnify the buyer. It is an entirely post-closing provision. You know, it's fundamental to understand how these contracts work. Every seller's representation and warranty is an individual insurance policy to the buyer. It's an additional right to the buyer. It doesn't create any rights for the seller. They overlap. Some may be triggered and others not. It's like buying an umbrella policy, an auto policy, and a home policy. Your auto policy may not cover it. Your home policy may not cover it. But if your umbrella policy does, it's more general. You're still covered. I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I apologize. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I am David Patinsky. I represent DuPont. My colleague, Mr. Fitzgerald, will be sharing the time with me. I will address the TMA fraud issue, and it is a fraud issue. First, Justice Holland. You did ask Mr. Shapiro, wasn't this a case where it was limited to the knowledge of Mr. Halter, Mr. James? And there are two provisions that conclusively demonstrate that this is a case that is limited to their knowledge. One is paragraph 5 of the party's confidentiality agreement, which was signed on January 31, 1997, in which the Wingard Group agreed that DuPont and Conagra would not be liable for any statements made unless they were contained in the party's purchase agreement. And then when you go to the party's purchase agreement, and Mr. Shapiro mentioned Section 3.8, but if you go to Section 3.25, which is at BD 352 and 353, that provision provides to the knowledge of sellers, and again, knowledge of sellers is a defined term in this agreement limited to Mr. James and Mr. Halter. 3.25, entitled Full Disclosure, to the knowledge of sellers, the representations and warranties of sellers in this agreement do not contain any untrue statement of a material fact or fail to state any material fact necessary to make the statements contained therein not materially false or misleading in light of the circumstances in which made. So that provision, which covers all of the representations and warranties in Article 3 of the purchase agreement, including Section 3.8, is limited to the knowledge of sellers, which means Mr. Halter and Mr. James.
Mr. Shapiro redirects the court to A-567 for the proposition that Halter got the Fisher memo and knew something was amiss.
Well, Your Honor, there is nothing in the Fisher memo which told him that this was a bogus rebate. What the Fisher memo contended, consistent, by the way, with what he'd been previously told on July 21. He gets the Fisher memo the morning of July 23. On July 21, he's told by Mr. Hillen and Mr. Christensen, who are the two senior managers of Tocoa. Mr. Fisher's the number three man. He's told on July 21 by Mr. Hillen and Mr. Christensen that this is a valid rebate. They vouched for it. They told him that it should have been paid, but it wasn't. And they thought it was still owed, even though it hadn't been paid. That's what the senior managers told him. Then Mr. Gunderson, who is the general counsel of DCV, and Mr. Gunderson is part of the management buyout group. He's partnered with Wynward in the management buyout. Mr. Gunderson, at the same meeting on July 21, he tells Mr. Halter that this is a legal obligation, it's binding obligation, it's legitimate. So Mr. Halter, even before the 23rd, has been told by both Mr. Gunderson from DCV, the general counsel of DCV, and by Mr. Hillman Christensen, the two senior people of Dakota, that this is a valid obligation. Now then he gets the Fisher Memorandum. The Fisher Memorandum doesn't say it's a bogus obligation, quite the contrary. The Fisher Memorandum says that he thought it was due and owed to be paid. We quote the provisions from the Fisher Memorandum in our brief. He thought it was due to be paid. It hadn't been paid. They booked the rebate, but he thought it was still due to be paid, even though it hadn't been paid. And Mr. Fisher gives, as part of the memorandum, and you'll see this in the appendix, gives to Mr. Halter, attached to that memo, is the Leddy letter. Now, of course, the Leddy letter, which Mr. Fisher has, doesn't say on it, cancel 12-18-96, which Mr. Leddy wrote on his file copy. The copy of the Leddy letter that Mr. Fisher has looks like a valid rebate.
So now Mr. Holter has the letter without the 12-18-96 canceled inscription. He has the assurances from Mr. Hillen and Mr. Christensen, the senior managers of Tocoa, that this is a valid rebate. And he has the statement by Mr. Gunderson, who after all is partnered with Lugar in the transaction as a management buyout, and the general counsel of DCV telling him it's a valid and legally binding obligation. So he didn't know it was
that. Suggested that when Halter got the fisherman letter that talks about immigrants being booked but not paid, that Halter would have known that would constitute a gap violation.
Well, that's another point. It was a gap violation. Mr. Halter did think it was a gap violation, and what did they do? They put his description on July 23, the facts he gives to, and by the way, the facts he gives to Winward on July 23 is the fact that's given to him by the CFO of DCV, again, Mr. Stapel, also partnered with Winward in the buyout. So he gives them the disclosure prepared by the CFO of DCV. But that same disclosure is put in the disclosure schedule as an exception to Section 3.8 in the party's purchase agreement. In other words, if you go to Section 3.8, it says, as we always do when you have a disclosure schedule, it says that this is in accordance with GAAP, and it fairly presents the financial position and results of operations of the company, except as set forth in any exceptions in the disclosure schedule. And that description is put in the disclosure schedule. The same fact description that he gives them on July 23 is put in the disclosure schedule as an exception to the Section 3.8 representation that it is in compliance with GAAP and fairly presents the results of operations. And Holding's own accounting expert that they hired to testify in this case, he admitted in his deposition that because the TMA disclosure was put in as an exception in the disclosure schedule, that therefore that in and of itself told anyone who's reading the disclosure schedule that this was either not in compliance with GAAP or did not fairly present the financial position of the company or the results of operations.
Mr. Patinsky, excuse me.
Yes, Justice.
Your responses to Justice Holland's question I think would be your answer to a more general question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. On the fraud claim, the TMA rebate, the appellant's position appears to rest on the proposition that there were three findings, all material, that were wrongly decided because there was no evidence to support them. I assume from your answer to Justice Holland's question, but more generally, is that yes, there was evidence to support them.
Well, yes, Your Honor, we believe that there's sufficient evidence to support every one of Judge Babiaz's findings in the Superior Court. This was a 7-day trial. He heard all the testimony. He made decisions on credibility, on who to believe, for example. He decided that Mr. Porter was not believable on the issues of that he testified to, and he was entitled to make that decision. I will just point out to the court that although it's not mentioned in Judge Babiaz's opinion, these facts are indisputable. That is, Mr. Porter admitted that he found out this was a bogus rebate before the closing, and it is clear that Mr. Porter submitted a certification, a closing certification for this transaction, where he certified and swore that the representations and warranties in the purchase agreement were truthful and accurate. When he and he said that at a time when he knew that they said nothing about it being a bogus rebate, and nevertheless he gave the certification saying everything was truthful. So there are plenty of grounds for not believing Mr. Porter, but the fact of the matter is every single one of Judge Babiaz's findings are supported by the record, and I do believe, and with all due respect to the court, of course, that under the left BBA standard of review, that unless this court determines that Judge Babiaz's findings were clearly wrong, it must support them in its decision. It cannot reach independent decisions. And by the way, there's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Holter had any fraudulent intent here. If you just look what Mr. Holter did, he told in mid-July that there's a problem with this rebate. What does he do? Does he try to sweep it under the carpet? No. He tells the CFO of DCB, go out and find out if there are any other problems that you haven't told me about. Go out right now and find out. And then he goes out and finds six more. And so then he says, well, we've got to put all these in front of Woodward. And he does that, and he doesn't craft his own disclosure. He relies on the disclosure that he gives, that is given to him by CFO of DCB. He then gives that to Woodward on July 23. He doesn't waste any time. They have a call, and at the call, and this is very significant, during that call, Woodward's not in the dark anymore. And they say, based on all of these seven disclosures, not picking one apart, two apart, but all seven, they say, we can't rely on Ducola. They use words fast and loose, intention in the statements of earnings. There's no controls or systems at Ducola. And so at the end of the call, these are their statements, at the end of the call, they say, we either want to reload or we want to take a big hit on the deal value. That's what they say. And they go off and they caucus after the call, and they come back and they say, we don't want to reload it, even though Mr. Holt said you couldn't reload it. They said, we don't want to reload it. What we want to do is get the big hit on the deal value, and that's what they got, $4 million.
Before you sit down, let me ask you one more question. What's the significance of making actual payment for an amount that wasn't due as far as misleading people?
Well, Mr. Holt said it wasn't due. Mr. Hoffman, again, was told this was a legitimate and legally binding obligation by the general counsel of DCB. Everybody else had said it was a promise that should have been paid. So even though it wasn't paid in 96, and even though he thought that was a violation of GAAP and we should put it in the disclosure schedule, he still thought they should pay it. So he thought, as an honorable person, he would pay the obligation. That was his view. And that's why he paid it.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Fitzgerald, and I represent ConAgra Foods, and I'm here to argue the contract interpretation issue. The question that comes down to what Judge Badgers had to decide and what this court had to decide is whether the buyers or the sellers agreed to assume the risk of the consequences that, unknown to Halter and James, one of the DCB companies had violated the law. That's what the issue is. We've got a violation of the antitrust laws that was going on. It's conceded that Halter and James did not know what was going on. When we were here last time, several years ago, the court held, and the Superior Court had also held, that the term liabilities in Section 3.9 was ambiguous. And this court remanded that to the Superior Court for a trial to determine the party's intent. We've done that. There was a full trial. Judge Babiaras gave everybody opportunity to say what they wanted, to put the testimony in. He was very patient with us. And as we get into the history of the negotiations, leading up to the words that are written on paper, what do we find out? What's the evidence? We know that initially the buyers wanted protection from situations that may give rise to a liability. They put that in their first draft that had a whole lot of representations and warranties. This is not surprising. Buyers want every protection that they can get. And the sellers came back and said, we don't want to give any representations and warranties. Again, not a big surprise. They were trying to limit their liability. What we have here is a compromise. And that's what this court has to recognize. We're dealing with an agreement that compromised on this and a number of other points. Both parties staked out their initial positions. The testimony is clear that in subsequent meetings, they come back and the sellers say, look, we will warrant and represent to you what we know. We know the financial statements because we've had auditors there. We do not want to take liability for situations that we don't know anything about because, and it's clear, DuPont and ConAgra were hands-off managers. It was the DCV management team that was actually operating the company. The board didn't know very much about the details of the operation.
Mr. Fitzgerald, excuse me, I just need to interrupt you at this point. There seems to be contention as to whether or not the antitrust liability had accrued, I guess, before the contract closed.
The Zenith case that Mr. Shapiro...
My question is, does it matter legally whether it did or didn't?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. The case that Mr. Shapiro cites talks about a cause of action having accrued. What we're talking about is, what did the parties mean by the term, quote, liabilities? And that's why I don't know that it makes a difference about whether these are accrued liabilities or not, because what we're trying to do and what the court's trying to do is to get into the intent of the parties as expressed in the written document and as developed through the parole evidence.
Well, so, you're talking about liabilities, but I'd also like you to address the concept that you use, which is lead, but we're talking about the company. You seem to be suggesting that if James and Halter didn't know, there was no knowledge. Mr. Shapiro takes issue with that. How do we decide who had to know something? Clearly, the people who were involved in all of this criminal activity knew that they were doing that.
Judge, obviously, the DCV people knew. Hilling knew because he pled guilty and went to jail. Fisher knew because he pled guilty and went to jail. Rose, he didn't testify at trial, but he went to jail later on for fixing prices after the sale took place.
Well, my question is specifically, where do we look in the record or the agreement to contain knowledge? You're suggesting to us that somehow knowledge is cabined into two people. And where do we find that in the record?
Your Honor, the agreement talks about, we talk about these quote knowledge qualifiers that we've talked about. And this is to the knowledge of the sellers. That is in an appendix, that is an exhibit or an appendix to the agreement, as we've all recognized that Halter and James's name should have been put on that particular document as being the representatives of the companies, but it was not. Now, that was a Scribner's error.
Now, how do we all recognize that? Is that stipulated somewhere among Mr.
I believe it was. I believe that all of the witnesses for DCV testified that the quick knowledge of the sellers that was mistakenly omitted from the contract meant Halter and James. And I believe there's testimony on that from Mr. Sikorsky, but it was not an issue at trial. Have I answered your question, Justice Jacobs?
I believe so. Okay, your point is that whether the liability accrued or not, the issue is whether the sellers knew about it.
Well, whether they knew about it and what the parties really intended, whether the sellers were going to take responsibility for something that had happened, for sins that had already been committed but were unknown. And I think that the course of the negotiations showed that the ConAgra and the DuPont people said, we'll represent what we know, we won't represent what might have happened. And they go through painstakingly all of these different clauses in the contract and insert these knowledge qualifiers. And I believe there's 10 or 12 of them that they go through. The one that really counts here is the violation of law that we've talked about, Section 313. But they go through a bunch of them. And if you go back and look at those different representations and warranties, they all represent to the knowledge of the sellers. For example, there are no violations of codes or ordinances or anything like that. Well, if there was a violation of a code or ordinance, under Mr. Shapiro's thought, that would be a court liability. And all of a sudden, now we would be in default under something like that. If they say that we're not in violation of any employment laws, to the knowledge of the settlement. Well, if they were in violation of employment laws, then that would be a, quote, liability. And it's clear by...
Well, what I understand is you're parsing it. Even if they were in violation, unless they could connect knowledge of the seller to the violation, there would still be no responsibility.
On those, that's right, Your Honor. And that was the way the parties allocated the risk. That unless James and Halter knew about a particular violation, then that was a risk that basically the buyers were taking. And remember, the buyers are bringing on a management team. I mean, this isn't an unfair, take it or leave it, we're going to shove it down your throat contract. This is something that the people who are actually running the show know about.
So then, coming back to my question, it's your position that even if it was illegal activity, unless you could show Halter and James knew about it, there was no responsibility.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you rely in part on the fact that there was a Scrivener's error that everyone, according to your acknowledges, should have had their names in the appropriate place.
That's right, Your Honor. It was a defined term. The only problem was that they didn't identify the two people that they were talking about in that particular error, in that particular thing. And that was a Scrivener's error. I've only got 30 seconds to go. We've talked about the facts. I really won't spend a lot of time arguing the rules of construction. Basically, the specific controls. We've got a general liabilities. We've got very specific situations. It's our position that the specific controls the general here. Unless you have any other questions, I thank the court.
Thank you very much, Council. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.